Is affecting real political change possible so long as governments have the ability to create endless money? Our guest today thinks that fiat money creation is a principal driving force in a political system where the incentive mechanisms make it easier for people to choose a financial benefit over doing the right thing. And the result of that is sort of an unsolvable political problem where governments can endlessly create money to endlessly cause people one at a time to look the other way. Michelle Weekly is a political Bitcoiner and the director of product development at Byte Federal. And she's joined us for a conversation about how Bitcoin has the ability to uncouple corruption in government. I'm Scott Dietels. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards. And part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. So if you're interested to learn something about political incentive mechanisms, money printing, and how Bitcoin can help, stick around. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward podcast. We're joined this week by Michelle Weekly from Byte Federal. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Scott.
Chatting lots offline before we get started. Always the fun stuff sort of happens before you press record. We're going to be talking this week about the connection between fiat money and political corruption. And this relates to a speech that you gave recently in what may be the best Bitcoin conference in the world in Prague back in June. Before we do that, maybe could you just tell our audience a little bit about yourself as a sort of a TLDR for listeners who might be new to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm looking forward to talking about Prague. It's an incredible event and an incredible city. I now do Bitcoin product development. And going back like 20 years, I spent many, many years working for the startup mafia. And I ended up in Dubai because I didn't want to go to Silicon Valley. So while I was living in Dubai, I got recruited to work in an industry called foreign direct investment, which is really the ecosystem that surrounds the World Economic Forum. I had no idea what was going on. I didn't know what that meant. I was like, what is FDI? But I just was in like the right place at the right time, or the wrong place at the right time, depending on how you look at that. And that started this wild journey that ultimately led me to Bitcoin. I did see, corruption at the highest level. I was shocked at what I saw. And I kind of burned out in flames in 2018. I came back to the United States. I sort of hid myself away in Florida, kind of retired. And I was speaking up a little bit about what I had seen, but nobody believed me. People just were like, this chick is crazy. And then 2020 happened. And for me, there was a significant silver lining in what we all went through during COVID. And that was that people started to believe, a lot of people started coming to me and saying, wait, what did you say? Did you say that they had done this? And so it really opened, it woke a lot of people up. It opened people's eyes to kind of the possibility that some of these things are really happening. And then I started talking more and more about it and, ended up working for an incredible company in the Bitcoin space, kind of positioned myself to be uncancelable. And here we are. So I did not join Twitter until Elon bought it. So that was kind of another big moment for me. Elon bought Twitter and I thought, all right, I'm going to do this. It took a little while longer for me to work up the guts to like just go full tilt, because I always thought, it's hard even for me, like in retrospect, to look back at the things that I've seen. I mean, I will tell a story and I will go, is that accurate? Or am I like trying to make it more dramatic? And I try really hard to just stick with facts. And this is point by point things that happened, but even myself, sometimes I'm sort of like, I wouldn't believe this shit if I hadn't lived through it, So I felt like I had to do it as myself, I had to be verifiable. Otherwise, it was going to be even less credible. So here we are, it has brought more craziness to my life, but it's brought a lot of amazing opportunities and people to my life. And I don't regret it one bit.
So you have this international experience navigating the world of sort of startup business, global startups. And then 2020 happens and you've come out sort of like into this Bitcoin spotlight, limelight, frontier. What was the connection? Like what was the progress through your experience abroad to coming back, 2020, Bitcoin? So like, what is Bitcoin to you, and why is the work you're doing, like how does this relate to this transition in your life?
So Bitcoin, I say that, you know, Bitcoin has freed me, and it really did that twice. I actually got into Bitcoin, and at the time, you know, Ethereum and traded shit coins for a little while. But I started that journey way back in 2017 when I was still living abroad. It's funny, I was in Cartagena, Colombia, and sat next to some Russian kid who was friends with all the guys working on developing the Electrum wallet. He was like, "Have you ever heard of this thing called Bitcoin?" And I was like, "Yeah, but you know, I don't know that much about it." And that started a journey for me. And ultimately, getting into that was what enabled me to pay my bills for a little while, so that when I left the world of foreign direct investment, you know, I could pay my bills. So I did that, and I had kind of done that in a silo. Like, I didn't know that many people that were in real life or online even that were involved in Bitcoin. I sort of did that. Like I said, I came to Florida in 2018. I hid out for a little while. And it wasn't until, you know, during COVID, I kind of came back to Bitcoin. I started learning more. That was when I really started studying like macroeconomics in a way that I had not before. And my understanding initially of Bitcoin was really more technical. It was sort of mathematical, like, oh, you know, there's patterns here and there's a halving every 4 years. And I was looking at all of that. And I just knew that I could reliably make money. Like, this thing was going up forever. And actually, you know, there were a lot of patterns in it. And I traded on those patterns for a while. So that was really the extent of my, like, I don't want to say interest, but that was kind of what I was doing for quite a while. And it wasn't until post-COVID, I went to my first Bitcoin conference down in Miami. And I was like, oh, shit. So I went, I was anonymous. I wasn't on Twitter. I wasn't, you know, like nobody knew who I was. I went alone. I didn't know anybody. And it was amazing. Like, I just wandered around. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. Like, I need to be involved in this, like, for real. So I was consulting at the time, and I had a few clients that no doubt would not have wanted to be, you know, paying me if I had started to be as honest and vocal as I am now. So I worked really hard to sort that all out. I was working for myself, but I had to kind of adjust some things. And then I Elon bought Twitter, and I was like, okay, you know, so based on the things that I had learned while I was working in tech in DC, I mean, I knew a lot of the stuff that was in the Twitter files long before that came out. So I was not going to be active on Twitter. So Elon did that. I got on Twitter, went to an event, and thought, okay, I have to be involved. I want to make friends. I want to pivot my career. I just don't care about anything but Bitcoin at this point, right? So it wasn't until, that was like 2022, 2023, when I sort of came back to Bitcoin and got involved from a social and a community perspective. Like, I started making friends. I started running my mouth on Twitter and doing podcasts and things like that. Then I, you know, got the role that I'm in now. And so it was really twice that Bitcoin saved me, you know, first from foreign direct investment and corruption and the path that I found myself on. Because if it wasn't for Bitcoin, you know, I don't know where I would have ended up, but it certainly enabled me to leave that role and to be okay. And then I came back again and, you know, again, it enabled me to be even more free and find people who were talking about the things that I was talking about, that I cared about, And so, yeah, it's been incredible.
I think it's such an interesting aspect of Bitcoin, how many different access points people can have. And so, like, you've had this experience with kind of like, you know, international funded projects and corruption, and Bitcoin has this incorruptibility. You know, like 99 other people would have 99 other completely unique reasons to, you know, first become seriously interested in it. And yeah, it's part of what makes it so cool. So flash forward, you're at Prague, incredible opportunity to speak to, like, you know, Bitcoiners from all over the world. And you have this really cool topic about corruption. And talk a little bit about the presentation and the idea of this connection between the problem of infinite money printing and you know, abuse of political power.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was for sure an incredible opportunity. I'm honored to have spoken there. And like I said, it was such a great event. I will absolutely be there again next year. And I had actually never been to Prague. And Prague was, you know, far exceeded my expectations. It was awesome. So I spoke about corruption and how, you know, people generally are corruptible. We like to think that we are good people. And, you know, I think most people are good people. But it doesn't make you immune from being corrupted. You know, one of the things that I said on stage was that if your price is not your life, then you're corruptible. And, you know, it's a little bit of hyperbole, but ultimately it's not, right? Because either there's a dollar amount that you're willing to accept, or there is something else that matters. Maybe it's your family or it's your children. And so I bring this up because I think it's something that needs to be discussed and built against. We need to build systems that are, you know, untouchable, because they can kind of get to anyone, you know. And people look at these stories that come out about corruption and they're wild, and they generally involve bribery. And it's like, oh, well, I would never do that. And you can say that all day long, right? But when somebody, you know, comes to you and says, you just have to do this one little thing and here's a massive check, you know, or maybe that one little thing is a little bit bigger and there's different types of leverage involved, and they say, you know, we've spoken to your children's employer or their teacher or something. I mean, these things are just a lot more complex than people realize. And I kind of used my own story to exemplify that. And the way that I ended up, you know, the story that I told on stage was about touring the ghost cities. And, you know, you don't just show up to the job on day one and go to Beijing, get in a helicopter and fly out to the ghost cities and sign on the dotted line that I'm not going to tell anybody there's nobody here. You know, that's not day one on the job. You get a job, you get a lot of money, you get a fancy title. And it maybe isn't, it's, you know, for me, like, it wasn't even about vanity. It was like, my parents were so proud of me. Like, you know, I've been like hopping from startup to startup. Like, I'm trying to build a life in Dubai. Like, here's this incredible opportunity, you know, and I'm doing good, right? So you take a job and it just, things happen like little by little. You know, the job that I had, they wrote a press release about me accepting the job and they put a bunch of stuff in there that wasn't true. And I went and I called them out. I was like, hey, you know, this isn't true. This isn't true. And they said, well, we don't really care. It makes you look good, so it makes us look good. And that was really like the first big red flag. But I'm already in it, right? I mean, what am I going to do? Like, oh, you know, this violates a code of ethics. I don't think this checks out. Like, forget it. You know, take your salary back. I'm going to go back to my old job. I'm going to tell everybody, like, it didn't work out. Well, you know, there's a lot more to it. So you do the job and, you know, like, things just happen little by little, incrementally. And we got this massive contract with a land developer in China. Seems legit, right? They need research. We provide research. You know, we provided a number of consulting services, and that's what we were hired to do. Checks out, right? So I was leading that project. I spent a lot of time in China, And, you know, again, it's like I'm sort of a bottom of the totem pole here. I'm kind of a fly on the wall in a lot of these situations. Like, I don't have any influence. I'm just doing my job, right? Which was a major theme that we saw throughout the COVID pandemic. People enforcing all of these tyrannical rules were just doing their job. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, we do our jobs so that we can take care of our families and ourselves and whatever. So, you know, things are moving along, and I'm in Beijing, and they pick us up in helicopters and they take us out to tour land development. It's like, wow, like, this is really cool. Like, this must be serious. I must be really succeeding, right? Like, this is a serious job. And then we land like in the middle of a street because there's no cars. There's no people anywhere. We just land the helicopter in the middle of a road. There's not a person to be seen for miles. And we tour all of these buildings, and they're talking about, you know, this development is 30% occupied. Next year it'll be 40 or 60% occupied or something. And I'm really at this point, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what's happening, because this place is not 30% occupied. It's completely empty. Well, what do you do? I mean, I'm like one of 10, 15 people, you know, and again, I'm the lowest person like on the totem pole. You know, I'm certainly in no position to say like, this is not true. Everybody go home. So you kind of like, you go along with it, and then you do go home, right? And you pretend that it's all cool, and you get a big bonus. You're like, okay, I guess I'll keep my mouth shut. I mean, you know, again, what are you going to do? So I did that.
Yeah, I mean, and the alternative would be like, it's not like you're going to bring ghost cities down single-handedly, so.
Yeah, you're not in a position to do anything. Even once you work up to the fact that, yes, clearly something's, you know, not on the up and up here, and then you decide, you know, this is not cool, I want to do something, what do you do? So I said this in my speech, you know, like, do you call the corruption hotline, like 1-800-CORRUPTION? Like, no, there's nobody to call. You know, and there are, of course, really specific examples where there is a specific action that, you know, has ultimately the ability to have repercussions. And people do that. And, you know, I think that's great. I think we need more of that. But the way the systems are built, they're really built to make sure that my story is far more common than the story of, you know, someone speaking up and there being repercussions. The systems are built to groom people that are willing to keep their mouths shut, and they work their way up. You know, this is kind of one of the wildest stories. I think it makes one of the best examples, but it's not the only story. You know, there's 2 years of stories just like this, where everybody participating is quietly, with no words, agreeing to the lies that are built. And the, I want to say, ramifications of that to them is generally the rewards involved in that. So you get rewarded, you know, you get bonuses, you get promotions, you get, you know, you work your way up. And then one day, you know, you're rich and you're invited to the World Economic Forum. And yeah, like, I made it, right? I mean, the people. So when I accepted that role, I had never even heard of the World Economic Forum. I worked in tech. I didn't know anything about geopolitics. I didn't care. I was one of these, like, I don't want to be involved in politics, like, leave me alone. But I suddenly was surrounded by people whose, like, entire life goal was to get invited to the World Economic Forum. And it's really a status symbol for a lot of people, and they believe that that means that they've made it.
It's 90% of the politicians in Canada.
Absolutely. You know, 100% of them, 98% of them in DC. So yeah, you go along with things and you get rewarded for your compliance, you know, your silence and your compliance. And it's all built to make sure that people stay quiet and are too scared to speak up. You know, it took me years to get into a place where I could and was willing to tell these stories. And I've had so many people come to me who have been through similar things or saw similar things and are not able to speak up. And that really, you know, that fuels me. I am endlessly encouraging them to speak up, because the more that we talk about this, the more we can, you know, fight against and stand a chance to like really take it all down. And I've seen some of them, you know, speak more and some of them just can't. There's a girl who I really, really like a lot. And her husband, you know, is still working in a position where, you know, she's like, well, it's not me, it's my husband. He'll lose his job. So there's all kinds of stories like this. And yeah, so it's all built really, really well. You know, in one sense, it's just a house of cards. All it takes is everybody suddenly being honest. But the fiat incentive structures are designed to make sure that people are as disincentivized to be honest as possible. And so here we are. You know, we all live in these corrupt places, you know, Canada, insane, the United States. We were talking before we started recording about how our respective countries are starting to resemble China. And, you know, people don't like to hear that, but it's the truth. And it's only going to keep going until people stop it by speaking up.
The money printing thing is really crazy. Like, this is not a huge amount of money in U.S. dollar terms, but there was a headline yesterday here in Canada that was $8 billion. The Canadian federal government had no explanation for how that money was. It was pandemic money that they couldn't account for any of it. And like, yeah, $8 billion in Canadian federal budget terms is a huge number. And it was such a poignant example of what's going on here. And this idea, I think, of when you can create unlimited money, you just have sort of like a golden goose for greasing anybody, you know. And it's like, if your alternative is, you know, personal destruction, or you can just kind of like hop on the gravy train with everyone else, like this is what you're talking about, right? Like it's no wonder that most people just sort of like make the easy choice. And corruption does look like a lot of different things. It might feel like it's not that serious, and you might actually get to go to some, you know, fun parties out of it or whatever.
Yeah, it's true. I was just pulling up, you know, there's some numbers that I saved a couple months ago, and because of course politics are heating up, and so we always, you know, we're continuously getting this narrative of like tax the rich, or you know, confiscate all the money from the rich and people like that. And there's math around it. If you like confiscated all the wealth from the richest people on the planet, it would really only run the government in the United States for 7 months. So there's a lot of problems there, right? I mean, it's ultimately there's a spending problem, which is what that speaks to. But further sort of down the line, what that extrapolates to is that they know that they can print money to continue to prop up the House of Cards, because they'll go down to Congress, or they'll get on there, you know, they'll do a press conference and talk about, we're going to tax the rich their fair share, and we're going to, you know, do all of these things. But it's just for show, because ultimately they have to keep printing money to keep up with this nonsense. You know, like all the things that they kind of virtue signal about and claim that they're going to do, they are like, you know, pennies in a bucket full of, you know, pennies on pallets of $100 bills. Like, it's just nonsense, the things that they claim they're going to do to get things in check, when the only thing that will really work is to stop printing money and, you know, force a hard money standard where you have to actually provide value in order to receive value. And that's it.
Yeah. I won't say, like, I don't know if it's a spending problem as much as it's a stealing problem. It's just that they don't think of it as stealing. And so for that reason, they're okay with it, right? Like, oh, we'll just offer this program. We'll just raise the budget and spend a little bit more. And like, that gets people excited. But it's like, that money is coming at the expense of the value of the money that you already have. So, and I saw, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, there was the, air quotes, the election in France, and they immediately are proposing a 90% tax bracket for anyone earning over 400,000 euros, which, you know, even these numbers, it's like one of the greatest cons, I think, with any of these like financial penalties that have a fixed number attached to them, is that 400,000 might be a lot today, but over a long enough amount, like that, once it's in, that number will never change. And like, in 30 years, everyone will be making $400,000. If we're still using fiat money, that'll be like minimum wage. And so that'll be a 90% tax bracket for everybody.
It's true. It's true. It's really true. You know, I was just talking to somebody about, I believe that the number was 11%, that the purchasing power of the US dollar was losing 11% per year. And so, you know, like you said, there's other numbers that, you know, analyzing, looking at inflation and also the loss of purchasing power. And I think we've kind of settled on a $200,000 number right now is what it kind of takes in the United States, if you live in any sort of urban place, to have just the life that a lot of us had when we were younger or that our parents had, you know, to have a one income family, to have a kid or two kids, and just live like a normal middle class life. For that number to already be at $200,000 is entirely unattainable for so many people. And you can easily see how it would just double to 400, you know, and the rate that that's all moving is accelerating. I mean, losing 11% of your purchasing power every year.
Yeah, like nobody would go to the casino and play a game that got 11% harder every round, because like by round four, it would be impossible to win. And that's kind of what's happening right now. Like, yeah, I think, you know, and this point about, it hit me thinking of this point about corruption, where it's like sometimes maybe the term corruption has a connotation of like, you know, it's this conspiratorial, malicious, you know, groupthink around a certain thing, but it could just really be also that the system itself is designed in a way that causes individuals one at a time to make decisions that make the most sense for themselves. And as a result of doing that, the output is a system that kind of like screws everybody else.
No, that's dead on. You know, I think that's a really good way to look at it. And it's true. We are, you know, the system has made sure that we are only looking at these very specific examples of corruption. And they don't even want you to understand it that well, right? They want you to get your headline and your every once in a while crook has gone to jail. And it's, you know, it's generally, like I said, bribery, because they want you to think it's just bribery and I'm not going to accept a bribe, so I'm good. But it really is more about, as you said, the way the entire system is designed. And sometimes, you know, we end up participating in corruption and we don't even realize it.
And then, of course, sometimes we do. We had a really funny one, not funny, in Canada, where the prime minister spearheaded an investigation into his own corruption. And you would never guess this, but they found that there was nothing to see here. Like they didn't find anything. So no corruption. To be found. So yeah, that actually did happen. Like that was a real thing. And yeah, like imagine if a sitting president was in charge of investigating his own impeachment. Like this is basically what happened up here.
Yeah, it is very common. You know, it's all happening in plain sight now. And I'm glad that it sparks more conversation. I'm hoping that we can kind of like all scream from the rooftops and the mountaintops and get enough people to understand so that we can change the world, you know?
I guess, you know, it is like, so part of the issue is that as long as governments can create infinite money, it just is going to be very difficult to untangle the broken incentives from the people who probably genuinely are trying to do good work and make positive change. So like, what do you think, you know, beyond that, like how does Bitcoin contribute to fixing these problems?
Well, you know, I think Bitcoin, first and foremost, Bitcoin represents the truth, right? It's auditable, it's verifiable. And for me, this has obviously become like a major theme. And I think it's great to be having these conversations. You know, COVID woke a lot of people up to like tyranny and the way that governments can and do come into your life and sort of impose. And I think that Bitcoin wakes up a lot of these narratives about incentives and corruption, even fiat money printing in and of itself. You know, so Bitcoin is really, it's obviously a protocol and it's many things. People can come to Bitcoin many ways. But you sort of, as your understanding of Bitcoin grows, so does your, I think, your acceptance of the truth. And, you know, I hope that this incentivizes people to want to understand things and kind of relentlessly seek the truth. So perhaps, you know, it inspires people in this way to do their own investigations, right? Like, we can't count on the governments to audit themselves, but maybe we can start auditing them ourselves and spreading that information far and wide and really just using it as a tool to help everybody understand how bad things are. And I think that that is what will motivate people to start making the necessary efforts to change.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, I get it. Questions around this often for people who are skeptical that a money system could ever be shifted away from the government being in charge of producing it. But, you know, I think it's also true. There's a potential outcome where Bitcoin isn't adopted widely by countries, but it's still just by virtue of existing, it provides a reference point for money printing. So if countries are going to still sort of spend recklessly in a kind of increasingly post-Bitcoin world, it's just true. To your point about Bitcoin is truth, it will just become obvious that the exchange rate between currency X and Bitcoin is going to progressively get worse over time as more people understand this problem more broadly. So I think that there's a lot of different ways. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be a kind of a full-blown Bitcoin revolution for Bitcoin to be able to influence the way governments think about printing money or the consequences of governments printing money.
No, I very much agree with that. I think we're going to see, so like the petrodollar has ended, but the dollar is sort of still, you know, we have oil priced in USD right now because of the longstanding petrodollar. I believe categorically that ultimately, oil will be priced in BTC instead of USD. And I think this is another example, you know, of what you've said. If we just continue to push the truth, the facts about the value, it provides a very powerful tool. You know, there's a chart that's online everywhere. You take a house and price it in dollars and in Bitcoin, and it really triggers, you know, like, oh, wow. And so perhaps we do have a parallel system for a period of time, maybe forever. You know, maybe we don't burn the whole thing down, but like you said, it just provides a point of reference that forces governments to put their money printing in check. I would certainly be happy with that. I'd also be happy with the complete and total destruction of the fiat systems. And then we just rise on a Bitcoin standard. But there would be a lot less destruction if it was, you know, as you have outlined, kind of more of a parallel system, especially for this period of time while things kind of transition. So yeah, I think that's a great narrative that is very possible and also really important to discuss.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I'm always really careful to, I have no idea how this is going to go. And no possible outcome, I think, would surprise me. Yeah, I've kind of stopped guessing at this point. I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I make a lot of wild guesses or predictions and, you know, kind of bothers people sometimes, but I'm unbothered. So, you know, and I also am fine being wrong. Like, here's what I think is going to happen. And I might be wrong, but I do feel really strongly, actually, that we're going to see a Bitcoin oil price index. I mean, actually, it already exists, but I think at some point you will turn on the news and, you know, you'll turn on the TV, you'll flip to the news, and there's just like a ticker, and it's going to show a barrel of oil in BTC instead of USD. And people don't realize like the profound second and third like effects that will create, and they might not even be, you know, they might not care, but that alone is a really powerful shift, and I think it's coming, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, because simultaneously to this, the BRICS countries that are trying to move away from that petrodollar system are trying to figure out a different way to do that. And for listeners who maybe aren't totally up to speed, there's been some ideas about sort of a joint currency between Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And Russia has just announced a framework for a digital currency nationally. But I think that the problem is, well, the problem is that's never going to work because those four countries are never going to be able to cooperate at a level that would be required for them to have an asset-backed currency because of the trust that would be required for each of them to believe that each other country had the assets, say it's gold. Like, it's very difficult to continually prove you have the gold that you say you have, let alone for, that's right, not if it's Bitcoin.
So perhaps they all create their own CBDC or digital version of their own fiat currency that is, you know, easy to on and off ramp into Bitcoin when they need to interact with each other. Seems pretty plausible to me. You know, they already, prior to the end of the petrodollar, the expiration of the petrodollar agreement a couple of weeks ago, they were already settling oil purchases in local currencies. So I think first what happens is we see that go digital as the BRICS countries are all adopting, you know, their own various coins or creating their own or whatever that may be. And then they're going to need a common language. And I think they're very incentivized geopolitically to want to get off of the dollar. There have been a lot of signals of that. There's been a lot of conversation around that. And so what happens? Well, they use Bitcoin.
Maybe turn back to the U.S. as we are heading into a presidential election this fall. And the Republican Party has, I would say, come out reasonably pro-Bitcoin. Donald Trump is going to be speaking in Nashville at the Bitcoin conference there end of July. What's your take on, do you think that this is the first election that is like a Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin on the ballot?
I do. And I'm a big advocate for it, which a lot of people are upset about. But, you know, it is absolutely on the ballot. And it's on the ballot in a way that a lot of people, unfortunately, don't understand. But there are a lot of people who do understand, and they've been making efforts to make this happen. And I personally am really, really glad to see it. I totally understand the I don't want to be involved narrative. And if you'd asked me, you know, 14 months ago before I worked in Bitcoin, I probably would have said, I don't care, leave me alone, I don't want to be involved. You know, here are my personal political views, but Bitcoin doesn't care. Bitcoin doesn't care, right? Unfortunately, the politicians do care. And so they have involved themselves in us, in our industry. And it's very, very involved in a way that, like, people do not understand. And whether you are for or against, you know, I know that Trump has been really polarizing and a lot of people don't like him. But I think that what matters more than whether you like or don't like Trump is stopping the current assault on the industry. And the current administration is attacking the industry just in a way that, you know, I mean, there's people in jail. You know, there's a lot of companies that are not operating in the United States anymore. And there's a lot more that's happening behind the scenes. And if that doesn't stop, if they are allowed to continue and just carry on, just the current momentum from FinCEN, from the DOT, from the CFTC, you know, from all of these attack vectors from the DOJ itself, which put out a press release about, you know, using MSBs. There's this whole other, like, alphabet language that I had no interest in being an expert in. The BSA, which is why you're subject to KYC AML globally. If we don't stop what's happening right now, American citizens, at least, are not going to have very many options to interact with their Bitcoin. This is the goal. It has been stated to us explicitly. I mean, there is not a shadow of a doubt that this is the goal. You know, unfortunately, the tech industry is very siloed. And I know there's a lot of open source options, and I totally support that. But the fact of the matter is, if you want hyper Bitcoinization, if you want mass adoption, if you want your grandmother and your cousin and Uncle Jimmy, and you want them all using Bitcoin and easily able to purchase Bitcoin from an on-ramp and put it in cold storage with the app or that they use on their phone to interact with their hardware device, we have to stop what's happening. Because otherwise, you know, Apple and the Google Play stores have a complete monopoly. We're currently fighting with Apple because they don't want to approve some updates that we've made to our wallet, which is one of the only wallets in the United States that you can still use without a VPN in order to use Lightning. And there are regulatory reasons for that. So that is all to say, you know, Bitcoin is definitely on the ballot. And I understand that people are inclined to want to not be involved, but the regulators have gotten involved and they must be stopped. And I get asked a lot about like, well, do you really trust Trump? No, I don't trust any of them, but it doesn't matter. Like, he doesn't actually have to follow through on very much. All we have to do is kick out the current people, get them out, and that gives us 4 more years to advance, to build more tools, you know, to negotiate behind closed doors with the hostage keepers, to work on, you know, getting things in place that we can all agree on. And if you look back 4 years and see how much has been accomplished, I think, you know, that's evidence enough to say, okay, 4 years is enough to give us, you know, enough time to build. And then again, we'll fight. And it's kind of this constant battle, right? But it's not so much about supporting Trump himself or any individual politician, because I don't trust any of them, no. But I do know what's currently happening. I am unfortunately intimately familiar with what's currently happening, and it must be stopped. So that's, for me, what it's about.
4 years would be an eternity with how fast this pace is moving. And I think it's also true that other countries, Dubai, Singapore, Russia, wherever, the innovation, it is going to happen. So I think there's a great argument. You might as well. I mean, it would be great. We're in Canada, it's the West. So we would I'm hopeful it happens in the US too. One of the examples that might be worth just pointing out, you kind of like glossed over or referenced, was the arrest of the developers of the Samurai wallet, who basically just created a Bitcoin wallet that allows for an obscuring of Bitcoin transactions. Writing software code is speech, right? Code is should be protected by the constitutional right of free speech. And so there are much larger potential implications for like protecting and enshrining freedom in general, I guess, more so than just Bitcoin is pushing on the boundaries of different aspects of what does technology even mean?
Yeah. We're sort of relitigating some of these battles that were had when, you know, in the early internet days. And it's a serious battle, you know, and it's one that we have to win. There's a lot of, you know, there's a few things there. I think a lot of people have unfortunately dismissed the case against what's happening with Samurai because they kind of, you know, they ran their mouths and they said some stuff that maybe they shouldn't have said, but that doesn't negate the entire battle. And, you know, to say, oh, well, they, you know, they deserve to be prosecuted is really, really like missing the forest. There's a much bigger battle that's being relitigated and we have to win it. It's a really bad precedent that gets set if they're able to claim, you know, these things are illegal, which they're not and they shouldn't be, but that's what's on the table. You know, it's not about a single transaction. It's not about, you know, they kind of, I think there were a couple things about like, you know, Russian oligarchs or something. Like my guess is, and I guess this because it's kind of the trajectory that I've fallen under, they built what they built and some regulator or some alphabet agency showed up and said, you know, here, you must comply with all this nonsense or we're going to shut you down. And they said, no, you can't. And they got kind of loud and ran their mouths and said some stuff maybe they shouldn't have said because they were the first, right? So they were privy to the enforcement action that has been coming down the line before anybody else. And, you know, I think I support them completely is ultimately what I'm trying to say. And it is really important to not forget that that's the battle we're fighting, right? Like this case is not siloed. It's not about them, you know, doing a couple, I think it was like 3% maybe of their business or something was considered illicit, which is a whole nother thing. I mean, that is that in and of itself, that we can't facilitate transactions with people that are citizens of countries that are sanctioned. I mean, that alone is its own conversation. And ultimately, the reason that people even believe that should be the case in the first place is because of the global dollar hegemony and the fact that we are completely brainwashed by the regulatory environment of the Bank Secrecy Act and the fact that we're all used to these AML KYC laws. And Bitcoiners need to be really, really careful that we don't allow too much of this to creep into Bitcoin, or we're going to be, you know, in a place that we don't want to be, and we're not going to be able to get
back. Yeah, it's a super slippery slope. I think about often the analogies between kind of Bitcoin and email, and you know, they're in some ways completely different, but what is the same is their, you know, their protocols for sending information. And it just happens with Bitcoin that you're sending an information that is a financial transaction. But, you know, you start to infringe on people's ability to send information to each other is really what you're talking about doing. And I think that the topic of financial privacy and financial surveillance is one that comes up a lot on the show, because it's just so important. Like, we've been convinced that the financial privacy is a privilege, and it should be a right. Like, we should have the ability to spend money without having to explain why we're spending it. We should be able to ask for our money from the bank without having to tell them what we're planning on doing with it. Like, we've earned the money, and this is something that's new. It's technology enabled. Like, this is not being a part of human society throughout history. Like, people have always had the ability to spend their money.
Yeah, absolutely. But they did it in cash. If you didn't want to be surveilled, you did it in cash, right? And so as cash has been eliminated almost from society, so has privacy. And so that's kind of become the norm, right? And I love the email example. I've written a couple things about that, you know, including the fact that most people can't check their email without Google tools. And, you know, like, are you using a Gmail? Are you using a Chrome browser to go check your email? Because if Google just decides, like, you can't access this, like, do you know how to check your email? And that's kind of my pushback on, like, well, we don't need big tech access to access our Bitcoin. And it's like, okay, yeah, as long as you're, you know, running your own node and have your own lightning channels and like all of this, we're not going to get mass adoption that way. So I think email is a great parallel, and the privacy conversation, you know, is really important. For a long time, we had cash, and that secured a certain level of privacy, right? If you wanted to buy something maybe you shouldn't buy, you could do it in cash. And there was enough cash in circulation from a society perspective that these were just normal transactions, right? We're at the point now where, like, if you want to buy something in cash, you have to go to the bank and get the cash first, because it's no longer the norm that we even have cash. So that's a problem. But if you go back, not that far back, like, you know, our grandma maybe had, like, my grandma used to keep cash in a coffee tin can, like, literally hidden, and people, you know, put cash under their mattresses so that they could maintain financial privacy and so that they didn't have to trust the bank. So these things all sound really familiar, right? That's why we use Bitcoin.
I mean, and your grandma didn't have to worry about that cash losing 11% of its value per year. You know, I think this is another thing that people aren't thinking about. But as you mentioned, like, this, the speed at which the money is losing its value is accelerating, which is part of the reason why I think nobody, like, the money that you have that you don't need now probably stays in something else, because, yeah.
It has to, right? Because you're just trying to keep up with inflation. And yeah, you know, the S&P is returning, like, I don't, you know, 7-8% or something. So we're, like, beating inflation, but you're not beating, you know, the rapid devalue. So yeah. And that, you know, I mean, that shouldn't be either. Like, you should be able to earn your money, put it in a tin can or a hardware device, you know, cold storage device, and forget about it until you need it. So I think, you know, Bitcoiners almost categorically agree with that. And that is a really good point that I think a large part of the, you know, the using cash less and less is because you need so much of it. Like, you could carry $100 or $200 with you and live for a few weeks not that long ago. But now it's like, it's not even going to buy you groceries for the week. So yeah, you know, you can you can see that if this continues to play out, we're going to be in like a Venezuela hyperinflation type of situation where we use fiat dollar bills to make art and kick it through the streets and stuff. But yeah, you know, cash, it's weird because it's always hard to like live through the actual change, right? And so we're living through like all of our payments have become digital. And for me, even when I was younger, that wasn't the case. And so you have to really think about like, well, how does this apply? How is Bitcoin similar? So I like to explain like Lightning Sats, for example, to non-technical people, like, you know, your sats are the cash that you've taken out of the bank and that you might use on a day-to-day basis. And then you have cold storage, which is like your old savings account. You're not going to touch that for, you know, a number of years. But we have to be really careful about the rules and regulations that are just taken from the fiat structures and just plopped into Bitcoin, or we're going to be very easily surveyed. You know, we're going to have all of this surveillance that they're doing now because all of our Bitcoin is KYC'd and it has to be OFAC compliant, and the on and off ramps are so regulated that we don't really have a lot of options.
Yeah, or we just start earning Bitcoin and then we have it the same way we would have had cash 30 years ago.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Employers being forced to pay in hard currency is an awesome win. And another one of these things, you know, you mentioned maybe we don't take down the money printer entirely, but if people start to demand to be paid in real hard money, that changes things. So absolutely.
Michelle, for listeners who want to like find more of your stuff online, we'll include links in the show notes, but where should people go to find more of you?
I am just on Twitter now, X. That's the only place that I really am active. So I'm there. It's just my name, Michelle Weekly. And yeah, follow me, fight with me. I don't care.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. It was great to talk to you.
Likewise. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the show, I want to thank you for tuning in as well. And I hope to see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.